everyone, and welcome to another episode of Horror Homeroom Conversations. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
I'm Dawn Keatley.
And in today's episode, it's part two of our deep dive into shark horror with Rennie Harlan's Deep Blue Sea. Blending science fiction with horror, the film follows a crew of researchers as they try to replicate the brain cells of people with Alzheimer's in the brains of sharks. Predictably, the experiment does not end well. Known for its divisive heroine, campy reinterpretation of horror tropes, and epic CGI sharks, Deep Blue Sea is a shark movie that actively resists demonizing the shark. But is that a good thing? We're breaking it all down today with spoilers, so stay tuned.
It resists demonizing the shark?
Oh, yeah. I don't think it demonizes the shark at all.
It's actually a film in which somebody says, two sharks down, one demon fish to go, and then it's the devil.
But that's coming from a perspective of somebody who's contributed to making them into the devil.
Okay.
And I think it definitely goes on the side of it's the scientists, well, in particular, one scientist who is at fault here instead of it being like the sharks.
Oh, two scientists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you think the first scientist knew?
Yes.
Oh, I never thought of that.
I would find it hard to do a scientific experiment without having some knowledge. Not like of that level. Of that level.
I could do a scientific experiment without knowing what I was doing.
But we probably should backtrack a little. So Dawn, you're the one who actually brought this film to us to discuss. So do you want to talk a little bit about what motivated you to dive in?
Actually, we got an email at Horror Homeroom from somebody who's promoting a petition that's out there right now to release the original ending of Deep Blue Sea. And we will put the link to the petition, which is unchanged.org, onto the post so you can take a look at it. The petition actually came out, it was started in August 2019, and they're trying to get, at the moment, 1,500 signatures. They're at 1,151, so not too far to go. You may want to sign it after you have heard our conversation, or you may not. But the point of the petition is that basically the original ending in which Susan McAllister survives and is the heroine, that was the original theatrical ending that the director intended. The petition argues that that is the correct ending, and they want to see it on some re-release of Deep Blue Sea. The director changed the ending at the last minute after a test audience hated the fact that Dr. Susan McAllister survived. While the director saw her as a heroine, the test audience thought she was, quote, an evil bitch and should die. So they quickly did a day's reshoot. And hey, presto, spoiler alert, Dr. Susan McAllister dies near the end of the film. So, yeah, one of the things we're here to talk about is which ending do we prefer? Do we think Dr. Susan McAllister should die at the end of the film? Or do we think the director's intuition that she's the heroine and should survive is the better ending? I mean, obviously, we'd love to see both because we like seeing alternate endings. But the point is, which is the best ending for this film?
Yes.
So Liz.
My personal preference is I would love to see the alternate ending because I think it's better if she does live.
Okay.
Because primarily, like, you're really letting her off the hook by killing her so quickly. I mean, what they did was so awful, and she faces no sort of consequences from those actions other than dying. And that's honestly the easier option when you consider she's responsible for violating international accords, the Harvard Compact, which says, you know, you're not supposed to be experimenting on animals in this way. You're not supposed to be utilizing animals in this way. And, you know, she is really the reason why all of these people die. And so just to backtrack a little, the film revolves around her and another scientist who have started this research where they want to try to replicate the cells of Alzheimer's patients mm-hmm. so that they can find a cure.
Yeah.
And to do that, they go into the shark's brains and they use genetic modification to try to increase the size of the brains. And obviously this has an impact on how the sharks live and act. And nobody else who is involved knows to the degree of what they're doing, because one of the other characters actually says, well, no, we haven't done that because it's a violation of the Harvard Compact. So, of course, we haven't done that. Come to find out in the end, yes, you have. We're given a backstory to Susan. Her father, it is implied very heavily, died of Alzheimer's. So she does have a genuine reason why she's engaged in this research, which I think does help to buffer some of the reason why she's not trying to do it for money or for fame. She's literally trying to solve an issue that happened to her in her family. But at the end of the day, these people die because of her.
Yeah.
So I want to see her live and suffer real consequences.
That would be a long film.
It would be, but I mean, even just to see her like put into handcuffs and do a perp walk, I'm okay with that. But something to say that you don't get to do something like this and escape justice. I know people will say, oh, that was justice, but not really, because the sharks, it wasn't her versus the sharks, really. It was her versus her colleagues who she kept in the dark and whose lives she put at risk.
Yeah.
So who all do we think knew?
Well, that comes up. I don't think I wrote down the exact words, but in my notes, I have in brackets, only Doc and Jim knew. So at some point, there's the reveal that those two did know what they were doing, you know, that they had sped up this process of growing the shark's brains. They were under some sort of deadline for the pharmaceutical company represented by Samuel L. Jackson to show results. So it was kind of about money, too.
I mean, we can't
rule that out completely. Samuel L. Jackson is there as a pharma rep because he's going to be buying this drug.
Do we think he had insight into it, or you think he was just laying on the pressure?
Yeah, he was just laying on the pressure. I don't think he knew what they were doing in terms of, you know, experimenting on animals in a way that clearly violates, you know, what's allowed.
That, I think, helps inform my decision. I don't want the alternative in an ending.
You don't?
No, because I think, so we were talking about this beforehand, I love the representations of women scientists. Mm-hmm. I love that she is a strong, smart, powerful scientist. She's accomplished a lot. She's really, you know, driving this type of research. So on that level, I would love to see her live and teach all kinds of other girls, you know. But what she was, it's right notion, wrong motion. It was driven selfishly rather than selflessly. I mean, she could say, I don't want to see other people suffer, but I think that she was thinking emotionally. And if you were truly just wanting to do it correctly, if you truly wanted to end the suffering, you wouldn't let pharma drive you. And I know that the idea is like, I've got to get it purchased so I can get it out there, but you would want to do it right. So I think that she compromised her values. And because of the damage that was being done, because of the methodology in harming animals, I'd say she's got to go. And selfishly, it just makes me feel good to see her die.
Yeah, that seems like what the audience was saying. But I also think, like, when the audience was watching it, we were dealing with, like, a separate set of expectations for our characters. Because I was thinking about how this is – Susan is really sort of the anti-hero story. And since 1999, we've had, you know, The Sopranos. We've had Breaking Bad. True. We've had Scandal. So we're used to sort of these morally gray characters.
Nurse Jackie. I love that show.
That's a great show. But that's exactly what I'm talking about. Like, we have a template now where I think audiences might be able to grapple with a morally gray character, which Susan is, in a different way. So I'm not sure that test audiences would have said necessarily, like, kill the bitch. I mean, they may have because, you know, it's still horror and it's still women in horror. But I don't know. I had, like, more sympathy for her than I remembered having the first time I watched the movie. And I think because it really does do that dance really well of showing that, like, this was something from her family. Like you said, it's emotionally driven. Yeah. She's not being driven, I didn't feel like, by greed. Even the fact that they ramped up the program was an answer to Samuel L. Jackson saying, if I don't see some results, I'm going to pull the funding. And so I'm sure to her it read as, okay, your last great chance to solve this horrible disease is being taken away. Like, would you be willing to roll the dice and violate international accords if you truly believe, like, I can solve this horrible disease? So that's why I think she's a little bit more morally gray, which is why I want to see the ending and how they treat that. Like, is she rehabilitated? Because I'm not interested in that. But I would be interested in seeing her survive and actually have to pay some consequences.
So then I have to also, like, pose this question. In other films, maybe creature features, just to make it easier, do we ever feel sympathetic for the person that creates monsters?
Oh, definitely.
The one that creates monsters?
I mean, you, Liz, brought up the mad scientist trope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they are almost always punished. And, you know, I see her falling within that category.
Yeah.
You know, they almost always die. They're almost always punished in some form. They're almost always the anti-heroes, villains of the film. I mean, Frankenstein.
That's what I was thinking,
starting
too.
Starting there.
Even Godzilla, even if it's not one specific person. Mm-hmm. I think, do we ever even consider feeling sympathetic for the people that create that?
Well, that's one of the questions I had for us to think about was, where would you situate this within sort of the mad scientist trope of horror? Because when I was thinking about the movie, I mean, obviously you start with Dr. Moreau from The Island of Lost Souls. And his sort of violation is trespassing against humanness, right? Like, the human is the one impacted. So Susan's different in that she's not really harming, quote unquote, humanity, at least according to her. She's harming an animal, which is problematic, but it's also a different conversation. So I think it's a little bit of a reinterpretation there. The second one I thought about was Dr. Philip Chouinard in Hellbound. And he is creating all of these monsters because he wants access to the underground, right? He wants the perks and privileges and the power that comes with that.
Yeah.
Susan's not interested in that.
Yeah.
The closest one that I could think about was Herbert West in Reanimator, because he's sort of the same, like, crazed scientist who wants to advance science and really isn't thinking about the human cost that comes with that. He's only thinking about the end goal. But what I found so interesting is that, you know, when people talk about Reanimator, they don't talk about, you know, West as, you know, that dick has to die. That's never part of the conversation. I think it's just because Susan is a woman and she's a scientist that the bitch has to die. Because why are those two motives being read differently when they're really the same? So that's why I want to see the alternate ending, because I think it's some bullshit that, like, they have to die. You know,
default,
that women get screwed.
And, yeah, by default, I think they just want to call women bitches. When they're, you know, good, bad dichotomy, you're either, you know, the virgin or the whore, right?
Right.
I don't know.
I think you're right in terms of the mad scientist tradition, which is pretty much always male, and it's always a man who wants to create things for his own power, his own godlike sense of hubris. And I do agree that Susan has an altruistic motive. Like, she doesn't seem to be interested in power for its own sake. It really is about saving people who have degenerative brain disease. So I can almost give her a pass there. But there is the part where she's deceived. She didn't say this to everyone on her team. She deceived them. And as somebody said, Carter says to her, "You used us."
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, I kept seeing resonances of Alien in this film. It's like, if you think about it in relation to Alien, she's like the robot. Can't remember his name. The one who knows that they're supposed to be getting the alien. You know, he's in on the plot. Get the alien, find the perfect killing machine, make money.
Yeah.
And everybody hates him because, you know, he drags the crew along and doesn't tell them, like, why they're there and what they're doing and that they're in danger. And she does the same. Like, she doesn't tell them that they're in danger. If she had a good argument, which I think she does, she could have told them and persuaded them to come along voluntarily.
Yeah. And I mean, that's definitely what feeds it, because she's not a heroine. Like, it surprises me that the filmmakers would have framed her that way, because in no way is she a heroine for those very reasons. But I think she's enough of like a morally gray character that I would want to see the repercussions.
So who do we think is the only hero or heroine?
I mean, I think it really sets up Carter to sort of be the one that you root for.
And he's a bit of a D-bag.
You think so?
Yeah, I do.
Why? I'm curious about this.
I just think he's brash. I just think he's, you know, I think he was driven by money. I don't think that, I don't know, I just didn't care for him much. I think the only person I liked was LL.
How could you not like exactly. LL?
Yeah.
I like Samuel L. Jackson's character. And I think because of him, not the character. Yeah, I mean, agreed. I'm not like in the...
Big Pharma?
I love Big Pharma. No. Oh, but the characters are interesting, though, because we were talking earlier about, and I did not remember this from the movie, about how it's setting up this dichotomy between like academic scientific thought versus real world spirituality / religion. And there's one point where Tom is talking to Preacher, and he says, you know, 4 years of Caltech, and that's the best explanation of physics I've ever heard. And he was shocked that somebody, you know, who isn't quote unquote formally educated would be able to grapple with those type of things. And then you also have Preacher, who survives in an epic moment by taking the crucifix off of his neck and stabbing it in the eye. You know, and that's how he escapes. And there's like numerous instances of him praying, which that kind of surprised me, because I don't remember many horror films where you actively see prayer happening. So that was a surprise to me. And then obviously the Susan and Carter, will they, won't they romance, which is secondary to like, because she is not kind to him. And she definitely makes allusions that he's less than, because she knows he needs the job. He, I think, is coming out of the penitentiary. And and so he knows that like his job prospects aren't that great. And so she uses that against him so that he kind of keeps his mouth shut, because he's the one who swims with the sharks and he realizes something is wrong. So he can see. And I thought it was interesting that like in horror, it's usually the woman who can see and identify with the monster. And here that's inverted. And you have the man being able to see the monster and sort of have that relationship. Yeah. And it only comes because they've made him, quote unquote, an everyman. He's not an intellectual and he's not a scientist. Yeah. And so I thought that it was kind of fascinating to me that he could only occupy that role by being placed as like an ex-con.
Yeah. I mean, she in a sense can't see the shark because she's a scientist. I mean, you know, she's the one that cuts off the top of the head and is looking at the brain, but she's not the one, like she has no idea there's anything wrong with these sharks. You're right. It's Carter who has a more intuitive relationship with the sharks that first gets a glimmer that they're acting a little strange. Like, sharks shouldn't be acting this way.
What do you think accounts for that tension between sort of the scientific world, which gets linked to the academic world in a way that I don't think we see all that often, versus this like very pointed focus on religion? Because I was thinking, okay, it came out in 1999, and I don't think there was anything specifically happening that would inform that. I mean, that's after, you know, the conservative religious right. I mean, they had lost power largely at that point. So I don't know if it was a reaction against that.
When was when did they do the series The Mist? Because you had the same thing happen.
You did. You're right.
And I loved the series.
I feel like that was much later.
Was it?
Yeah, because I think we had the website by the time that was out.
Oh, yeah, that'd be 2015, 2015.
Yeah.
But going back to it, I also have to validate the whole mad scientist trope, because that didn't even cross my mind. Because I think I'm so used to just saying shark film that it didn't even cross my mind. So that was well played, very thoughtful, and now I'm sitting here thinking about it.
And I also like you, Gwen, reviewed this film, and you reviewed it very positively, and you brought up how many times religion comes up. I think you have a bunch of quotes in that piece. And it is, I think, almost exclusively Preacher. Mm-hmm. And... I think it's interesting that he'll start praying, but then it turns into some, and then we're going to kick the F's ass. So he has a very pragmatic view of religion. But he is the one that talks about demon fish and the devil. So he's the one that talks about, you know, that kind of demonizes the fish.
Was he brought into the loop?
And sees it as a religious struggle.
Yeah.
But that's interesting.
Was he part of the conversation that he knew that Susan had done this?
That's interesting. He wasn't there when that all went down because he was a floor below in the kitchen when it happened.
So maybe in a way, he's sort of like the default viewer, which, you know, we go into a shark movie and we kind of expect that it's going to be the shark that's the main perpetrator.
Yeah. But as you said, it's actually the scientists that created the demon fish. They're not inherently demonic, but Preacher doesn't know that. There's the biblical story of Jonah and all of that. I mean, large fish become monsters in the Bible, I guess.
No, I was just trying to think of now how each character views the shark. Mm. So she views the shark as something to be used. It's a means to an end. Yeah. It's completely objectified.
Yeah.
That's why she probably completely misses that there's something wrong with it because it's not a thing to her. And then you have this guy, Preacher, who views it as a demon. And I don't know how some of the other ones would actually view the shark. Carter, I think, likes them. Mm-hmm. But that's it. So maybe that would posit Carter more as a hero, even just for his ability not only to see the shark and what's wrong with it, but his more favorable view of something that other people see as not favorable. So paralleling his story with theirs.
Yeah. I mean, it's Carter who says at the end, because Samuel L. Jackson, early before his death, says, you know, he asks them sort of hypothetical, you know, he says, these sharks are thinking hard and clear. What would such a shark think about? And Carter at the end says, that's what an 8,000-pound Mako thinks about, freedom.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost poignant, you know, like when he said that, I was like, oh, I kind of want the shark to escape from the pen and be free.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he seems definitely most in tune with sharks as sharks.
And I think, too, like it sort of puts a cap on the hero's journey for him is that he is trying to sacrifice himself at the end. He's like, you know, I'm willing to be exploded with this final shark if it means, you know, everyone is safe and it doesn't make it into the open waters. And so that's why I read him as a hero. But I mean, you're right. He is kind of a D-bag.
Yeah.
But I also wonder if that's not us in 2023. Evaluating the character versus the 90s, because was he really all that different from
Crocodile Dundee?
100%. Yeah. That's exactly who I was thinking about. That's crazy.
He even kind of looks like him.
Not a knife.
That's not. So we've taken this movie pretty seriously, but this is a fun movie. This is why I love the movie. I think it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
The CGI sharks are everything. What was your favorite moment? I mean, we probably all have the same favorite moment.
Absolutely.
And that would be?
Samuel L. Jackson's death.
It's at around 59 minutes, folks.
Even if you don't watch the movie, you gotta go to that part.
Yeah.
It's so great. It's after he gives like this rousing speech and you think he's going to be the one who's going to, because the whole time they're talking about him surviving an avalanche. Yeah. So he is a survivor.
Yeah.
And then that shark comes out of nowhere and just bites his head off. It's amazing.
He survived snakes on a mother effing plane.
He did. Yeah. But I don't think you should sleep on the first scientist who dies. And they're, he gets his arm, I think it is.
Yeah.
And
his arm's ripped off,
And as he's bleeding out, they try to medevac him out, but there's like a raging storm, as there tends to be, and they lose control and he goes down into the water and he's strapped, which is actually horrifying.
That is terrifying.
Like, you're literally under the water.
That's really chilling.
There's not much that makes Dawn laugh, but that image just made her laugh.
Yeah.
And then he comes and he like breaks the glass and you just see his dead corpse.
Smashed up against the glass.
It's everything.
Yeah.
That is pretty good.
What was the most annoying moment?
Oh. Well, I just have to follow up on that, though. Like, if we remember in Shark Night.
His arm bit off.
The guy had his arm bit off, and we were all like, it's a little unrealistic that he can then, like, swim, fight sharks, like, survive through much of the rest of the film. And, you know, this guy gets his arm bit off, and he's helpless. as one would be. And if he was your able to arm is ripped off.
He could share a poignant moment with his girl through the glass before his demise.
That was wild.
He gets sucked through.
In fairness, though, they were in a lab type situation, so they had access to things. Whereas, you know, in the other movie, it's just a bunch of dumb kids.
Wasn't someone a med student, though?
Yeah.
But I don't know that he had any, like...
The tourniquets.
I was going to say twine, but that's not what you use on a...
I never wanted to get my arm ripped off around you.
No, I thought you could just take your necklace off and sew up your...
That's right.
Suture up your...
Oh, don't remind me of that scene. That was a reference to The Shallows, also on our last podcast.
So, Gwen, did you have shark facts you wanted to lay on us?
I do
What about the most annoying film?
Yes. Oh, yeah, the most annoying.
The most annoying scene. Do you not have an annoying scene, or did you just love it all?
I can't think of an overly annoying scene.
Yeah, I can't either. It was pretty damn good.
I think so, too.
You don't have one? I thought you'd have one.
No, I mean, I was a little annoyed when they're trying to climb up the ladder.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And then, of course, it's like the damsel in distress kind of situation. I was like, we really didn't need that. But beyond that, I mean, that was just a little gripe. Yeah. The rest of the movie, I loved when Susan goes into her office to try to recover the data. Mm-hmm. And the shark has followed her into the room and she's like climbing on tables and falling into the water. I thought that was really well done.
I was going to ask, do you think that there was a good level of tension? Do you think it holds up?
Yeah, I thought so.
There was. I did too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think specifically because of some of those scenes that you're talking about where you're just like, oh my gosh, she's standing on a desk. Is he going to get her? Like, I mean, because these sharks obviously leap out of water to attack people.
Yeah.
And helicopters.
Yeah.
They're plotting.
Yes.
They're plotting, hunting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because we found out prior to this that Makos have the largest brain to body ratio of the sharks.
Yes.
And are known to be intelligent. So perhaps that's why they chose that.
Yeah. Especially when they have their intelligence on steroids.
Yes. Yep.
It's a good time.
I could use that.
Me too.
Yeah, me too.
Me too.
I'm willing to say that I think this is a better movie than Jaws.
Oh.
People were not happy with me last podcast. I got a couple of emails like, how do you not like Jaws? What's wrong with you? You're not a real horror person. I'm like, listen.
Okay.
I think this is a better movie than Jaws.
I still feel that Jaws builds up better tension. When you can go that long without showing an actual monster, and I think for me, the lasting implications of everybody, even if you have not seen that movie, you know the...
Oh, for sure.
And you know the lines. I think I'm going to need a bigger boat, And the fact that so many people were terrified to go into the water after that. Like, I don't know if we would have the same impact if people had seen Deep Blue Sea prior to Jaws.
Well, probably not, because they're not demonizing the shark. So you're not being positioned to be afraid of the shark. And plus, it was the 70s. Like, you didn't really see a lot of stuff. Like, now you can go online and you can see, like, real shark attacks. So I guess the standard is, like, so different in terms of what is shocking.
Yeah.
In Deep Blue Sea, you have hyped up, large-brained Makos that think and hunt and want revenge in a laboratory setting. So that's just much more distancing than Jaws.
True.
Yeah. But you just have your basic shark stalking the beach. But what about, that's what was so terrifying about
it. What about Jaws 3 when he got into SeaWorld down in Texas, you know?
Yeah.
I forgot about Jaws 3.
But I do think that there's a lot about Deep Blue Sea that is really better. I mean, I think the kills in it are shocking. Yeah, they're just shocking. Like, they do seem to happen when you're not expecting it, like all of them.
I think that does a better job making you care about the characters, too. Like, I genuinely liked all of the characters, maybe save for Susan. Like, I didn't find anyone highly obnoxious.
Yeah, true.
And people die in unexpected ways. Like, I didn't expect the first character who, Brenda.
Oh,
yes,
Brenda
who was up in the tower. I didn't expect her to die so early.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect it to be like a non-shark related event. Yeah. And I think it does a better job keeping like the humor consistent. Whereas with Jaws, I always struggle with, I just don't care about those characters. If they all got consumed, I would have zero problem with it. Mm. Although I appreciate the humor in Jaws because it's a little bit more subtle. I just don't care about the characters.
All right.
I'm noticing, so after we did, what was it, Shark Lake? No, not Shark Lake.
Night.
Shark Night. And what was the Shallows? There's another bird in this one.
there is another bird.
Oh, yeah.
Is there something with birds and sharks?
Well, aren't birds like metaphorical on the ocean in terms of like leading
people
sailors
to land?
Yeah. Maybe that's why.
I guess on that note, too, I think to myself, like, as we were sitting here talking about it, do these shark films do good or bad? And for whom?
They're all bad.
There ain't nothing
they're
good about them.
Deliciously bad.
Yeah. Nothing good about it for the shark.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I mean, the shark's not demonized in this one, but I just think, too, like, what good do shark movies do? Like, for people's perception of sharks. You know what I mean? Because I come back to Jaws, and everybody wanted to go out and slaughter sharks.
Yeah.
When, in reality, sharks are not likely to kill you.
I've always kind of thought of, like, creature feature, like, animal attacks movies, I should say, as being just a way for humans to sort of like reiterate their dominance and to make you feel a little bit more secure about a natural world that seems increasingly at risk.
Why do we think shark movies have caught on and not just grizzly bears? Because I mean, I know there's been a couple grizzly bears, but...
And now there's a sloth.
Oh boy.
Movie.
I want to see the sloth movie. I'm going to see the sloth movie.
I mean, that's not going to be good for sloths. But anyway.
Like, I want to know the pacing of the sloth movie. Like, how do you pace a sloth horror movie?
I want to know, will it be a two-toed or a three-toed sloth?
That's right.
That's what I want to know. But no, I think about it. Like, why has this stuck on as a genre? Mm-hmm. And it's always a summer horror film. And why?
I don't know what the actual statistics are, but do more people just go to the beach than they do camping?
Go camping?
Good call.
I don't know.
Because woods is a trope in every horror film, too.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess it's more terrifying to have hillbillies than grizzlies.
For some of us.
Yes. You know what I mean? Like, that's caught on.
Yeah.
I mean, with sharks, you have the predator plus invisibility. I mean, with grizzlies, when they're coming, they're coming.
Yeah.
But with sharks, they're apex predators that are also, like, hidden from you. I mean, that's what creeps me out about it. And, you know, like, going in the water, like, you can't see what you're about to step on.
I think about it, too, just the nature of being in the water, because you're already at a deficit compared to a shark.
Exactly.
So, like, it's really hard to get away. I mean, everybody's probably had a dream where you try to punch something underwater and that doesn't happen. Or, you know, you try to punch something and it feels like you're underwater and it's all slow.
Nope.
That might be a Gwen dream.
Okay. Guys, write in. Come on, back me up.
Well, I read an article. It was called "A Neoconservatism in the Science Fiction Cinema, the Representation of Neoconservatism in Deep Blue Sea."
Ooh.
Oh, wow.
And it's by, I hope I say this name right, Narae Halei-Tugin. I'm going to link to it. I apologize if I've massacred that name. But the gist of it was that this is very much like a neoconservative movie and that it's advancing that, which you can kind of see the religion being exemplified. Mm. But I was wondering if you agreed with that. And if so, if you saw any other ways beyond the discussion of religion where that might be the case.
It's funny. I didn't think about it until you were sitting here talking about what was possibly going on in 99. Why did we see the religion? And it seems how it was, you know, religion versus science and the everyday man versus, you know, the academic.
Yeah.
And I started to think about how the reductive stereotypes of both political parties. And it felt exactly like that.
Yeah.
Like, it just felt like the most reductive example of both of them. Like, oh, you're just this and you're just that. And let's pit them against one another.
Yeah.
I think you're right about that. Because I think if you track, like, at least United States politics, there's always been vitriol, obviously, in politics. But I think most scholars look at the Clinton presidency as when the two camps became enmeshed and it was no longer like, let's at least have civility. Mm-hmm. It just became open season. And so that would track because 99 would be seeing, like, you know, the end of his presidency, really. Yeah. So having gone through that, that's interesting. Good observation, Gwendolyn.
That's because I was listening to you very attentively.
Yeah.
That really is an interesting point. I do feel like the political lines in that film feel contemporary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Carter would definitely be a conservative, you know, good old boy, dare I say MAGA. But, you know, that's obviously a stereotype because he is also intuitively sort of in touch with the sharks.
Because, yeah, you wouldn't necessarily see that type of a conservative maybe being so, for lack of a better word, liberal in their positioning about somebody that's done time in many cases. But again, if you put him and pit him against the scientist, it kind of starts to look like latte liberal versus,
oh, definitely.
You know, and who gets lost in that? The everyday man.
Right.
I mean, it is, what's the hunt? You know, it's sort of like, I almost feel like the characters map onto the lines drawn in The Hunt between, you know, the sort of elite academic liberals versus, the every guy. We haven't talked about Jan, the other woman. Is she the one that helplessly falls from the ladder and then gets eaten by the sharks?
Yes.
Jan's an interesting character because I was trying to figure out.
Does she have a character? I'm struggling to remember anything about her.
She does, in that she's like the quintessential, like, hapless female in a horror film. Like, all of it is mapped onto her.
Yeah.
And, you know, she starts by, I don't know if it's her husband or her partner, is the first scientist who's killed. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And she doesn't really serve any purpose other than really to be a counterpoint to Susan. Because whereas Susan is, you know, I'm going to violate international treaties and I'm not even going to care about it, she's continually trying to toe the line of saying, like, we're trying to do public good. We're not trying, you know, to do anything outside of the realm of what we're supposed to be doing, and still sees the sharks as animals instead of a means to an end. And I think it's interesting to me how the characters are largely deviate according to one side, right? Like, some see them strictly as a means to an end. And that goes beyond Susan, because obviously the first scientist. I think, too, like Tom Scoggins kind of sees them as a means to an end, too. Whereas there's then this other camp that sees them as actual animals and understands that, you know, there's a sacrifice being made that they obviously never consented to and sort of is respectful of that.
So can we have a successful shark horror film without comedy?
Not for me.
I guess Preacher provided the comedy, right?
That was
it was pretty serious beside him.
Oh, I thought it was all fun. Oh, I thought it was all literally hysterical. Yeah, I guess
you could see the deaths as being funny only because they were sort of so, like, outrageous and grotesque. And
I wonder if they actually mean them to be funny.
That CGI is bad, but bad in the best possible way.
Yeah.
So any other shark facts you want to throw at us?
So, yes, I guess what also feeds into anytime I watch these shark films, and don't get me wrong, I am a gluttonous shark film junkie.
Yep.
I can consume anything from Shark Week up to, you know, the stupidest shark horror film, and I'm going to love it. I love Bruce in Nemo. I mean, I just enjoy it. But part of the reason that I'm so firm on my belief about the scientists and what they're doing, too, is because I will always lean towards the shark rather than somebody with Alzheimer's. I've had that in my family. It is a horrific disease, but just my moral compass leans that way. So that's why I like to just kind of point out the fact that we are always much more dangerous to the shark than they are to us. So I have statistics here from the International Fund for Animal Welfare, Greenpeace, The Guardian, New York Times, and they're all kind of consistent. But every year there's fewer than 10 deaths globally due to shark attacks on humans. There are sometimes bites, but deaths per se.
That's way lower than I would have thought.
Yeah, me too. That's because we've been making you watch shark horror.
Yeah.
So you thought there were more shark deaths.
They track this in Florida. There's like a main guy that kind of keeps the stats on it too. And it's really interesting. You can track sharks too. It's very, very interesting just to kind of see what's going on, what they're doing. You know, so they've started to try to, you know, create a different affect towards sharks by doing some of these things. You can adopt them. But to put that in perspective, about 2,000 people die every year from being struck by lightning.
Wow.
So your shark deaths are very, very minimal. Again, you're more likely to die from a vending machine falling on you, a coconut falling on your head.
That is how I'm going to go.
Bees stinging you. Probably all of them all at once.
Yeah.
That's how I'm probably going to go. I'm going to be trying to get food out of the vending machine. I notoriously shake it. I'll probably get stung by a bee. Then lightning's going to hit me.
It's all over.
I had a rock destroy my windshield the other day because
I was
talking crap about somebody. And I felt like that was just kind of karma hitting me. So I owned that one.
Literally,
I can't even be mad. I can't even be mad. But the IFAW also reports that every year humans kill around 100 million sharks.
Oh my
yeah.
God.
That's horrifying.
There are some graphics online that you can see on a bar graph how many shark species and shark numbers. And it's a conservative estimate going down, and it's like decimated. I mean,
jeez.
Decimated. So then they were saying since 1970, the global abundance of sharks has declined more than 70%. And it's largely due to increased fishing pressure. But it's also a number of other things. So the shark finning industry is a huge one. And if you have not ever seen something horrible, you want to see a true horror, there's a documentary called, I think it's called Fin. And what happens to these sharks when they take their fins is worse than any horror movie.
That's awful.
They use it for shark cartilage. They use it for shark soup. They bycatch. So every time, that's why sustainable fish, if you eat fish, is really important, because the bycatch, all this stuff that gets stuck in the gill nets and the long lines, it just dies and gets thrown out. And so it's just knocking down the numbers of sharks, like at a really, really, really alarming rate. Yeah. And we stand to lose a lot of them. It says half of the world's 31 oceanic shark species, because there's definitely much more than that, are now listed as either endangered or critically endangered. So when I hear things like that, mm-hmm. anytime I see any scientist, even with the best intentions, possibly threatening the whole entire species, subspecies of sharks and rays, I'm like, So that's why sometimes I beat myself up, too, about loving these shark films
yeah.
that demonize the shark.
Right.
Because I'm like, oh, my God, they're so good. But if people don't know this stuff,
yeah.
you know.
But that's why we're doing the podcast, so people can yeah. know. And you can enjoy your shark movies, but then also maybe take positive steps to help
yeah.
decrease that.
Maybe an answer to the question, why do sharks feature in so many horror films? Maybe it is guilt. I mean, maybe the number of horror movies, the grotesqueness of the deaths in horror movies are all about our guilt for killing so many of them, you know? It's like coming back.
That's a good point. I was reading something not too long ago for my dissertation, and there's a couple people that have really argued that the purpose of horror is less fear, more guilt.
Yeah.
And that would track with that.
I mean, Carter says at one point when he's yelling at Susan when they found out what she's doing, he says, "You've taken God's own killing machine," more God, "you've taken God's own killing machine and given it will and desire. You've knocked us all the way to the bottom of the goddamn food chain." So, I mean, it may not just be about guilt. It may be about our own sense that maybe we aren't as powerful as sharks. So, you know, we're anxious about our own place at the top of the food pyramid.
You know, there's been so much like flooding and issues, especially in Florida. If we're going to start to see an increase in animal attack movies, because I'm just watching the news, the rhetoric has been really interesting about like, well, what's coming in with those floods? You know, are they snakes?
Do you
gators?
See the rattlesnakes?
Oh my God, no.
We're not watching snakes or rattlesnakes. We're not watching any of that.
Oh, Rattled by far one of the best TV horror movies.
It really is, but never again.
It's terrifying. Like, I'm not scared of snakes, but some of the scenes in that I see in my nightmares.
Do you see the size of those snakes?
No. Two things.
Don't scare the snakes.
You've traumatized her.
But did you see that story? This happened in Pennsylvania where a hawk dropped a snake on a woman who was cutting. She was out there mowing her lawn perfectly happily.
I would die.
And a hawk, which was flying over her, dropped the snake onto her.
So now I'm going to stop talking crap.
It gets worse then, because the hawk, of course, wanted to retrieve said snake. So it, like, pounced on her and was, like, gripping her with its talons, trying to rip the snake off of her head.
This really happened.
It really happened, swear to God. I mean, they had an interview with the woman who was in the hospital afterwards, and you know, she was talking about how traumatized she was. I was like, no shit.
I would never go outside again.
Yeah, really, never.
The odds of that have to be
Talk about being killed by vending machines.
Right?
I mean, that's way more likely than a hog dropping a snake on you.
Although, all the more reason to not mow my lawn today.
Yeah. I mean, last time we talked about whether these phobias are created or whether, you know, they're a reflection. I can now tell you every day when I take my dog for a walk, I'm going to be thinking of snake dropping on
me. Well, I'll send you the story. Just
please
so
don't.
It can be.
But you saw, even with the floodwaters, there was rattlesnakes.
Yeah. I was going to ask about that because I did not see that.
Oh, yeah.
What was happening?
They had some of the floodwaters receding because they obviously didn't get washed in.
Was this in Florida?
Yeah.
And
there was rattlesnakes just hanging out. But I don't know. If the film industry was in Florida, I would think that we would see more of them.
Yeah. I think so. I think you're right about that.
The leader of shark bites in the world, I believe, is Florida. And it's, again, you have exponentially more people in the water that are probably stupid, but not to victim blame. I don't know. You hear
or
a lot of
bash the South.
You do
every chance you get.
But you hear a lot of stories of these people that are going out fishing in waist high water, and they have bait like with them in the water, or they're at dusk or dawn, and I'm like, come on, do you not watch anything?
Yeah, but we digress. Yeah. But I mean, I guess we're imagining what kinds of, maybe there will be an escalating number of creature attack movies. I mean, there have been quite a few that have come out of Florida that I think are like Crawl, hurricane with the alligator, that are sort of loosely about climate change and more storms and bigger storms and what comes in with the storms.
Yes, and we have a podcast on that.
Oh, I thought
and
that
I'll
climate
try
change,
to link to that.
I thought climate change was a hoax. That's what I keep hearing on TV.
Not in this room. It's not.
Yeah.
Elsewhere, perhaps.
You would think you'd see more on, too. Like, God, the wildfires and just things that are completely out of our control. I'm surprised we don't see more on that.
I agree.
Like more horror films about fires?
Just in nature striking back, period. Because it is really happening.
Well, we're going to start needing to get some of those sort of survivor stories that become part of cultural lore. Because everything is on fire and everything's going to hell. And so you need those examples of survivorship.
If people would just
And the 70s did that great.
Oh, yeah.
I'm almost wondering if we're not going to revert back to that in a way.
No, we have leaders that say we should just rake and we won't have wildfires. You know?
And it's interesting, too, that all those Revenge of Nature movies came out after we started learning about the ozone layer and holes in the ozone layer and CFCs, you know. Day of the Animals, one of my favorite revenge of horror movies, actually references that scientific study. And it kicked off all of these films about nature striking back.
Yeah. You had a lot of legislation that happened then.
Well, any final thoughts about Deep Blue Sea?
Watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
agreed.
Watch it. 100%. Yeah. It's on Amazon Prime right now. And I think next year, and The Petition. Look for The Petition.
Oh, yeah?
And I think next year there's going to be some sort of DVD release, possibly, because it's the 25th.
Okay.
Wait, am I doing the math right?
I think so.
25th, 35th?
You should. 35th? I wish people could see the three of us trying to do basic
24.
Math.
Yeah.
Counting
we're not mathematics.
Yeah.
The math ain't math.
Those who can't do.
It'll be the 25th anniversary next year. In 2024.
And that would be a good time to release the footage.
Yeah.
So we can make our own educated.
Yeah, I mean, we want to see the footage. Even though I think the doctor should have died, I want to see the original ending.
Yeah. I'm curious because especially if they framed her as a heroine.
Yeah.
It's probably her, you know, and Carter.
Yes.
You know, smooching in
that
the sunset.
That will probably happen.
If that happens, I'll be so mad.
Yeah. Well, tell us what you think. Have you seen Deep Blue Sea? Did you love it as much as we did? We would love to hear. You can find us on all things Horror Homeroom. You know how to get in touch with us. I think the next movie we're going to do is Cobwebs.
Cobwebs.
I think we're,
Cobweb.
Cobweb.
There's only one.
And I actually have already watched it. So yes, Cobweb. And I think we may do it in relation to Black Phone.
Oh,
I'm, going to advocate for that because I think there's a lot of crossover.
Good. I love
cool
Black Phone.
Beans.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we will talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.